good afternoon or good morning if you're listening to the repeat on Sunday. You are listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, London's radio art station, and www.resonancefm.com on the Yuletide internet. Today's show presents The Red Suede Jacket Part 2, a collage of audio sketches and memoirs about and by John Nixon, also known as Jelly or Jell, who is based in Leicester, with observations and memories provided by friends Steph Rayner and Bob Hughes. Interspersed with snatches of Hopscotch Boulevard, being Jell Nixon on percussion and Lee Spreadbury on keyboard, with additional music by Cyril Davies, Jimmy Smith, Jimmy McGriff, Mose Allison, and others. Produced by William English and edited by Dan Wilson.
Come in, but yeah, I mean, that was a little claim to fame there, quite a And, you know, Sarah Vaughan with Count Basie, they would come round. So you got to see all the greats. And that's one of the best things about them.
Right.
About that period, you know, for me, was able to see them all before they all died off.
So, okay, so you were still at school at this point?
Yeah.
Right. So what was your kind of, I mean, do you remember what your sort of attitude to clothes was at that time? Did you have a...
Clothes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was taking a sort of keen interest in clothes. I had a couple of pinstripey suits with a couple of buttons.
Yeah.
You know, pretty colourful shirts and things like that. Well, one part of the West Coast thing, what was the look really? You know, the brogy shoes, the loafers, the loafer shoes.
So you'd see these musicians on stage and you'd think they look great.
You'd be impressed.
Or you saw photographs.
Yeah, you'd be impressed because I think that America, over the years, probably America lagged behind a little bit in fashion, but at that point they were way up the top. The Ben Sherman shirts and the original button downs, the half sleeves.
Right.
Shirts that you could wear outside of your trousers,
yeah.
And then you could get stay pressed caps as well, you know. So that look was very much the sort of West Coast jazz look.
But you could get the clothes here. I mean, you could
Places like the Irish manufacturing were starting to get it there.
The Irish bar in Leicester.
Yeah, but there were places. If you looked around, I mean, I used to pick the odd things up in Lewis's. You know, you could actually find one-off things, or in one-off gents outfitters, you could find one-off things. I think the first time I went down on a clothes buying spree in London was with Dave Parkinson, because we took the train together and went down. So that was probably, that'd be later, that would be 64, but until that point, you would find odd things around. Yeah, well, the first job when I left school was at a very large manufacturing wholesale chemist. And I worked on the dry floor, which was a huge floor full of amphetamines and various other dry products, which were actually made at the top. One guy used to work at the top of this huge machine, and he would wear the mask and everything, and they would spill all these tablets down, then they would come down on my voice. We would bottle them up, and they'd go on the shelf into sort of 1,000 bottle jars and things. And I worked on the floor with Mr. Cheney, who was about to retire. He worked there for about 50 years. And another guy, Stan. So there was just the three of us. But Stan and I had a lot in common because he had a huge jazz collection as well. So we dropped into the same thing together. I mean, he knew everything about jazz, you know, at that particular point. He had a wonderful collection. I was 16. He was... I was 15. 15, I think, I left school. Yeah, so I was 15. And he was 30. Also, his lifestyle was pretty good. The clothes he wore were nice, wear nice cord trousers and Chelsea boots. And, you know, and he always kept himself immaculate. And we liked that style. The style was very much together. But unfortunately, you know, as it went along, you know, I got curious about the tablets,
right.
And tried one or two, you know, because, I mean, when I asked Dan what they were for, the dexamphetamines, you know, the yellow ones they used to churn out, he told me, really, they were for slimming tablets, you know, for sort of like neurotic women and things, you know. So I thought, well, I'll give them a go, you know, and the thing was, it all sort of together a bit sort of... When we decided to do the club scene, and it was, you know, the clubs didn't open until midnight, and you didn't come out till 6 in the morning, you kind of needed something to give you a lift and stay awake with. And also in London, there was getting a lot of coverage as well, the Purple Heart scene, that was basically being run by the Craze and all this sort of thing. I remember it being exposed in all the daily papers and the Sunday papers at that particular point in 1964. And basically, you know, I was helping myself to these tablets, and I ended up getting into a little bit of trouble with it, and they sent. Actually, I got arrested for in possession of amphetamines that were traced back to the warehouse, and I really owned up to it. But the management were sort of very apologetic about it all, because they thought that they sort of misguided me, and I got into, you know, so they sent a very, very good representative to court and managed to get me off.
Oh, wow.
With the whole thing.
Right.
That was the first job. Right. I had.
You were going to with Eva in London.
Yeah.
Did you go with Steph then in the club?
We did, but Steph, to be honest with you, and I don't think he'd mind me saying this, but he very rarely went in. I mean, Jack and I used to go in. Steph would. I mean, for instance, one night we were in the scene club.
Yeah.
It must have been about 3 o'clock in the morning, and Jack and I had been in there for a couple of hours, and a guy came in and said, "Oh, you better come outside. Your mate's dead out there. He's dead in the car." So we rushed out, and Steph had actually got the heater on in the car with his feet up at the dashboard, and he was asleep, you know, he was right out of it, but his face was sort of suppressed to the window. And then, I mean, he only really sort of got the heater on, but this guy thought he was trying to poison himself, you know, with the carbon monoxide. So that was funny, but that did remind me that Steph very rarely used to go in anywhere, and even when we went to places like the Dungeon in Nottingham, they would send me in first, basically, to check the place out, if it was worth going in or not, and then sometimes they would come in, or they would use my pass out, and we would take turns of going in. We were very rarely all went in together, right, anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Why did Steph stay outside? He just stayed on his own in the car.
He used to stay on his own in the car, basically. Yeah. I mean, now and again, you would come in for a wander round, but then you'd probably scuffle off back out again.
Uh-huh.
He would remember a lot more.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Than me. He's got a terrific memory.
So when was the first time you saw Jelly?
I don't know. That's a hard one. That's a hard one. It's gotta be. I got a lot of visions of him. I got visions of him walking around Leicester with the red suede jacket on, with canaries in cages, and jumping up and down, and speeding, and dancing in the streets, and Jelly. chilly. It's almost, there almost isn't a time. It was as if it was, you know, meant to happen. There almost isn't a time to meet Jelly. Jelly was just there. It was like, it was something waiting to happen. It was an accident waiting to happen. Do you know what I mean? It was just a time when, it's so long ago. It's a bit like, you know, people talk about the 60s. If you remember it, you weren't there. So I got no idea. We were popping pills and living it large. And, I don't know. I really don't know. Long time ago. Early 60s.
You mentioned the red suede jacket. So do you think that was the first thing? Would that have been the way he looked when you first met saw him?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Right. When we went to his place, I guess his old man was maybe he'd gone out or something, and Joe played a bit of piano and started jumping up and down on the piano and things, and I thought, this guy's nuts. He'll do. And so yeah, we formed this kind of like bond, and I just remember being in toilets, taking pills. Maybe with girls in toilets, gel in the toilets. We were all in the toilets just doing pills and then getting out on the dance floor. That's all I remember. Pills, dance floor, pills. Right. The Morris Minor, must have been in the Morris Minor, the boot was full of pills. We had bags and bags of pills. Right. That's all I remember. Just carpets full of pills. Yeah. Everywhere was pills. You used to open the car up. My girlfriend was sometimes in the boot of the car with the pills. It was just madness.
Who was your girlfriend at that time?
Don't know.
So this sounds like the phase when people started wearing suits, wasn't it? I mean, Steph had a maroon suit, I think, with a very long vest.
I do remember a maroon suit, yeah.
With a long vent and...
About 18 inches or something like that, yeah. We did go to a period slightly on from that, where people like Scotties in town were doing very good off-the-peg suits. And I remember they wouldn't give me an account there. So I remember one time tapping Steph, and they actually got a couple of suits on Steph's account, which I later paid him for.
Right.
One was sort of silver with flashes in, and another one was sort of almost gold. And I used to wear these for DJing when we moved on in 66, which was the penultimate year of the collapse of the demise of the mod era, really. And at that point, when I was DJing, they looked good for that. But prior to that, the period you were talking about, people used to go to Burton's or one-off tailors. I mean, there was that original sort of gay tailor down near the Wine Lodge. Do you remember the Wine Lodge? That later became Yates's. Originally, it was Page's.
Uh-huh.
Now, Clive Page, the son, he was a mod as well. We used to call him Cloggy. And he used to give me the keys to his house, to his folks' house. They lived at Champion, whenever they were away.
Yeah.
He'd say, "You got anywhere to go, Joe?" I said, "No." He said, "Here's the keys, you know. You just go back to his place and then crash and put sounds on." And people were very sort of accommodating that way. But there was a whole crew of people going to Burton's at that time. They need suits made, you know. When they measured you up, you get a cup of tea or coffee with biscuits. Yeah, and then you go back about 10 times for fittings over the next 3 months, you know.
Yeah.
And then shoes became very prominent, really. It was okay having the suit, but you had to have the real shoes. And of course, in Leicester and in the suburbs, shoes were not a big commodity. And we were still dealing with Saxons and Clarks. So you had to make a point of going to London specifically for shoes. 62 and 63, with the demise of the Cuban heel, if you like, which was pre-mod. After that, you had to go to London to get the shoes.
Yeah.
But Wardour Street was the place, because there was a Rivetta, their biggest branch there, and Rail as well. And the two of them, I think, collectively really had the best shoes in England. And you could buy that the very flat shoe with the slightly turned up lip, chiseled toe, and you'd have to go to London because They just weren't accessible anywhere else. You could hit the suburbs and you could buy, because it was getting subtle and it was about having something different. It wasn't always about, I think some people think the mod thing was all about having a look. There was some sort of immense army of people with the same look, but because it wasn't, there was always something that separated each individual. Or at least I used to like to look at it that way.
Yeah.
If it was to be taken seriously, you know, you would have to shop at Rails or Revels for shoes. And then again, it was changing quickly. Out they went, and in came the interlaced shoes. You know, those, interlaced shoes. And really, sort of the workmanship was incredible. And most of them were being imported from Italy, but some were being designed here. They were still being made in Italy. So yeah, I mean, it was changing very quickly, and it was all about being subtle.
Where do you think you got the red suede jacket from?
I seem to remember that he knew a few guys down Carnaby Street, and I don't know whether he introduced me to Carnaby Street or we got it together, but he knew a couple of guys that were like faces in London, like, and we were talking about measuring the vents on the backs of jackets, how long they should be and how much the pocket handkerchief should be sticking out the pocket and how the turtleneck should look like this or look like that. And there's a couple of guys at JL knew that would be older than we are, that were the real faces, and they were wearing like horse riding kind of breeches and cavalry twills and just completely outrageous with like walking canes and you know, that real kind of Beau Brummelly kind of mod. It's not really a mod, not a modernist style, is it? It was all mixed up. You've got the preppy look, you know, you've got the American preppy look, you've got the this kind of English aristocrat look, you've got the suave look, you've got the crazy pillheads, you've got all these things.
Yeah.
But I think Gel stayed on that pillhead look all the time, whereas I interwove between these different kind of, he still got like the different vents and things in the jackets, but he was more, he's more pure, he's more, you know, to his belief.
The inevitable question that I've asked you all individually, as probably two or three times now, and it's the question about...
The red suede jacket.
Which wasn't red, from a start.
What colour was it?
It was like a orange, carmine colour.
I didn't see any orange in it at all.
Yeah, well, it was not really red.
No, I saw it as being pink.
Yeah. But what about it? Where, who had it first?
There is no first, it was only gels. Well, you think no. That we shared it?
Well, no, there were several people wearing it.
Was that?
But on loan, was that?
When did this happen? I mean, if we're talking that, I only see that jacket never left.
Jack borrowed it quite a few times.
Yeah, it did end up in Coventry.
But you nicked it in the first place, didn't you?
Did you?
I can't remember where I got it from.
But it was like made to fit.
Well, everything fitted jelly.
It was made to fit. So you don't know where it came from, Joe, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I can't remember.
But it was like, it was new, it was like really fresh when you had it on.
Yeah, and I just really don't have a clue where
it was. Really, it was really before we ever went down to places like Petticoat Lane. Right?
Are you sure that you do actually know that you nicked it? You know,
no.
You're just not...
No,
you
not even that. No.
You wouldn't have bought it, would you?
Was it a deal, like for pills or something? Was it like a lumber deal?
It might have been. It
seems to me.
Yeah,
do you remember those guys that you used to know that were older than us?
In Paddington.
Yeah. Wherever we went with it, there was always some guys that were slightly older.
Yeah.
Was awesome. Like, yeah, do you remember those guys that used to wear the cavalry twill suits and the walking canes and stuff?
Yeah. Walking canes?
5 years older than us. Yeah, they had the
broke
scarf.
Shoes.
Mm. And they had the scarf, they had the cavalry twills, they almost had riding jackets on.
Yeah.
Those guys, who were they? Because they were around the Mingo and Hammy Albert, they were older than us.
Mm. Mm.
So, do you remember when you first saw Jelly in the red suede jacket?
No.
You told me you did last time.
No, I saw you in it outside
in the
shoe.
In the jacket.
Outside the shoe factory. Okay. When it came with the...
Yeah.
The two...
But you used to wear that when we went to that club in the top of Bond Street, you know, the one on...
But yeah. I see gel in it everywhere. I see him in the scene club. I see him... Tottenham Court Road.
Yeah, but I think this is even before that.
No, but I see him everywhere. I see him in Coventry. I see him...
Yeah, but that's all later on.
Everywhere, everywhere you look
for a
jacket.
Yeah, probably
did.
It was all smooth at the collar. You'd worn all the pockets down.
I think got like a leather bit of the collar.
The last bit.
But it had double vents.
Yeah, the last.
Yeah, always double
vents. The lapels were...
Because I bought a suede jacket, but mine was that, you know, when they first did the Wrangler suede jacket in the brown?
Yeah,
it's like a jean jacket.
Yeah.
Carnaby
suede. A Levi jacket,
Was it suede?
Yeah.
It's made a black one. A copy of a Levi, but it was John Brown suede.
It was John
Mike. Like the monkey jacket type thing.
Like the black one, black suede,
That's true, he did.
Yeah.
I thought he was blue, but it was black.
Well, it might have been sort of midnight, but it was very dark.
I think it was dark blue. Could have been
black. Suede was good, though, wasn't it?
Speedy on the Congas that later joined Traffic. Pete King, that's still on the jazz circuit now, was lead tenor sax. And generally speaking, it was a really good sound. So you could spend a couple of hours in there, then you could mill up the road to Ham Yard, just by the Windmill Theatre there, and then you could go downstairs to the Scene Club, which was one of my favourites because the records in there were sort of impeccable, and they always played something new. The thing about the Scene was, the DJ knew when everyone had picked up on a record, because the thing was, it was the first double turntable, although everything was still on mono, stereo hadn't been produced yet, and it wasn't the usual DJ of talking crap. It was all about playing music non-stop and fading in and fading out. But records like Charlie and Ines Fox, Mockingbird, for instance, you know, that comes to mind because every fifth or sixth time they put it on again because people would be in that. And so that's how the dance movement really developed as well, how people would actually take on a particular kind of dance. And a lot of those grooves and those moves were sort of fabricated in places like the Scene Club, and then they were later shown on programmes on the TV, emulated on programmes, you know, Kathy McCown and Little Mickey Tamler, you know, on Ready, Steady, Go.
Right.
So everybody knew the sort of dance before it was actually televised. So that was a favourite, and then there was the Last Chance Club on Tottenham Court Road, and then there was places like Clute's Clique.
Oh, right.
If you went down a little bit further, there were clubs like the Eel Pie Club on Eel Pie Island, and then you had the Ricky Tick, was it? Yeah, Ricky Tick. And then there was another one that I think Eric Burton had a partnership, and they owned a place. Didn't used to go there very often because they're a little bit heavy, but it was called Count Suckles, that was in Paddington, and they used to pump out the song music as opposed to the...
Right.
Maybe the Motown that was being predominantly played in the other clubs.
Yeah.
There were smaller clubs around there as well. Discotheque upstairs in Water Street, where they used to throw mattresses down on the floor. There was a big dance occasion in there. A lot of the new dances as well were really sort of mocked in there. But you could come out there and wander across the road onto Frith Street, where the original Ronnie Scott's was.
Yeah.
And there was a little basement club down there called the Ad Lib. And that was a nice little place to go when you come out of the clubs later, because that was still running. You'd wander out about 6 o'clock. The tubes wouldn't be running. There was no transport around. So you'd go and spend a couple of hours down the Ad Lib Club. And there was a couple of coffee bars around, wasn't there? The Two Eyes that was already famous from the rock era.
Yeah.
And
Macabre.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
You get a wonderful cup of coffee in there, really. It was the first real good espresso coffee house in London.
Well, I may lay 100 on a bet this time. Tomorrow night I can't cover your dime. Next week I could be over the hill. I'm just trying to tell you people how I feel. You see me rocking as I pass you by. Don't talk about me cause I could be high. Just forgive me if you will. I live the life of love and I love the life I live.
So you went to the Scene, right? And you would park in Ham Yard out the back.
No, you couldn't park there.
You couldn't.
You wouldn't be able to park there.
But
in the motor.
No.
But
no.
You were always known for staying in the car, weren't you?
Everyone used to climb in the car in the end because that was like one of the places. Yeah. So you had the club, but then you had the car outside.
Yeah.
So you
had
another place where you could go.
Yeah.
You tended to stay in the car more than go in the club.
No, it depends where it was. Say if it was.
Yeah,
like,
he ended up there more later, but it took more.
Say it was like, you know, say the Mojo or something.
Mm.
I'd be one of the first in. But
Peter Stringfellow, remember?
He was straight in the Mojo, that's right.
Yeah, never messed around, because Northern Girls did it for me.
Yeah. So the Mojo was
Sheffield.
Oh right,
across the, and it was really weird because here you were coming into this transposition of technology. You know, when you were driving into London, you had the post office town, but when you were driving out of Sheffield, all you had were hills with sheep grazing on a Sunday morning,
cobbled streets.
Yeah. You know, but there's something about the Northerners. Northerners blocked.
Yeah,
were different, weren't they? They're even more
friendly. City.
Because Londoners always had that hard Cockney edge, but Northerners, they talked to you for twice as long.
Yeah, they're very friendly over there, weren't they?
Yeah.
Sheffield, they were.
They were a bit too smart in London.
Yeah, you felt that. A bit elitist.
Yeah. And also, the authorities didn't know so much. I mean, like,
yeah, you could
twice
get
in the scene when he got raided, and it was really rough, you know, with the bus that comes along and takes all the girls.
Yeah, I was part of Sunday nights in Nottingham. Yeah, from our time. We used to do Sunday nights in Sheffield, but we used to alternate maybe.
Because that was Saturday night in Sheffield.
I did like that.
We set off the trends.
I thought we were all peaking at
In the dungeon, it went for us to turn up, so they could see how we were going to dance. And do you remember, we used to set off lines in a dungeon. We come up with a new dance, and all of a sudden you'd look, and a whole line of people were doing the same thing.
Yeah. I was down there with Keith Moon. You know, the who guy?
Playing the pinball.
Yeah. And he'd run out of drugs, and it was Sunday morning, and the gig on Saturday night, and they were doing another one Sunday. And we were still in the club Sunday. No, the club didn't shut, we were still there.
Yeah.
And it was 11 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning, and he said to me, Jenny said, you're going to travel. I said, no, I was hoping you up because I was hanging around with him. I thought you might have a few, and you didn't have anything. So he says, you know, there's a chemist open across the road, Timothy Wise. Just keep me in. He sent me across to Timothy Wise. And I bought these Benadryl inhalers. You remember them, the inhalers?
Yeah.
There was, when you tweet the cotton wool out, it was full of Benadryl.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and okay, I just used a chew on it. And we both, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we both had mouthfuls.
All right. I distinctly remember that amyl nitrate because you just took off, you just cracked one of these things, and then you were just floating around for a while. Felt like 3 hours, and it was only a few seconds. You know, so I sort of went off in time.
That we were in the back of a
time
van.
Travel.
We were at the back of the van. It went round an handkerchief, you know, really very quickly. Yeah. You'd split one open, and you'd go round really quickly.
It was just like travelling in time. I just took off, bang, and then everybody was still doing exactly the one I got back, and I knew that it was only a few seconds later for
hours.
The biggest influence on me with the mod thing, I have to say, was 1962, as far back as that, when I went to see the Rolling Stones and they were in Black...
At the university?
Black Dog Tooth Check. No, it was in Margate.
Oh, OK.
I was on holiday down there in Margate, you know, purely by chance, just hanging around. And we went to Dreamland, and the Baron Knights topped the bill. And the Rolling Stones, and I thought, that sounds interesting. So kind of like, and it was still the days of the Ted walking around with like knives and, and you know, crepe shoes,
and three-quarter length
Teddy boys. And it was quite frightening, really, you know, being in there as a young teenager, because I wasn't really anything. There was this flavour of the beatnik thing coming through. And what it was, there was a group of people outside, not even inside, but outside, on the scooters, with their berets.
This is Margate.
Yeah, this was way in front of its time. This was in Margate 1962. And that was the biggest, to me, that was the biggest interest. They had stovepipe trousers on. Mm-hmm. And before, and nobody had been seen in these. It was all bell-bottom stuff. And it was so much more.
Yeah, that was it. Bell-bottom and the plastic neck.
Maybe French, maybe Italian, there were influences in there.
Right.
That you wouldn't have automatically detected, perhaps. And I think that was the biggest point, really, for me. More so than London, really, you know, because London then became a bit more.
So, did these guys, the guys on the scooters, were they from London, or you reckon they were from
that area, you know, down there, you know, Kent or whatever?
Oh, right.
Margate's where it kicked off, isn't it?
Yeah, Kent and down there. That would have been a big influence.
62.
You know.
Yeah.
Do you remember any more about the clothes at the time? Can you think of any? I mean, at this period, did you, was it sort of? I suppose it was changing pretty rapidly, but you
Depending on the season, I mean, getting back to suede again, suede and leather was always popular right. in the winter. And more the sort of Madras look, zoot suit type affair yeah. was probably in the summer. Plus there were the monkey jackets, the suede monkey jackets, they were very popular. Oh. Yeah. If you were lucky enough, you could actually pick one up in the Army Navy stores. Oh. I mean, they would sell stuff that people sort of left behind, good quality stuff that left behind on the railway system.
Oh,
you know, right. You know, do you remember that yeah. stuff? All the people didn't collect and left the luggage office or something. And you'd be able to go in and pick up a good monkey jacket. And then, of course, you know, you'd wear a Fred Perry with that.
Yeah.
Or a cotton Fred. But all the way through, really, the button-down collars, they became larger. Mm. And then they became smaller. Ginghams, checks, stripes. That's what I really remember, predominantly. Very colourful. Plus, you could also, I mean, they were the first people, John Stephen was the first one to come up with the concept of, if it doesn't fit, we'll make it fit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could walk in and go for a pair of cacks, and if they were too long, they would actually tailor them to your requirements before you walked out. They had working tailors right. already on the spot. So that was, the clothes were very accessible that way. What they didn't like was you, taking stuff back, which right. nobody ever did that anyway. We formed a partnership with a couple of sisters, Linda and Jane Hollingsworth. And there was another girl, Judy Shelf. She was a Fijian girl. Do you remember, Judy? And the three of us did this sort of dance cabaret act over the other end of town. And Tony, do you remember Tony Gorbich, Gobbit?
Yeah.
He was the main DJ in Leicester. He got us all together to do these dance sequences. And this night, we were supposed to go through these dance sequences in a cage, suspended, you know, the usual sort of discotheque thing, we were suspended up the top, going through all these dance movements. And that day, it was on a Saturday, I was approached in town by a guy called Jeff Stevenson, and he asked me what I was doing that night, and I told him, and he said, "No, you're not." And I said, "What do you mean, I'm not?" He said, "It's because you're DJing over at the Burlesque Club." I said, "Well, I'm not, because I'm dancing with Tony and the girl." And he said, "No, you're not, you're DJing." I said, "Well, I haven't got any records." And he said, "Well, you have now." He said, "Because I've got plenty, and we're going to go to the record shop and we're going to get them now." I said, "Are you sure about this?" He said, "Yeah." So anyway, that was it. So I started the Burlesque. Prior to that, the Burlesque had just been a coffee bar,
right,
with another floor that was basically empty. So George, the owner, is now George Neal at Hairdressel. He put the original, using the concept of the DJs in London, he put the double turntable in there, stuck me behind it, billed me as, you know, Jelly the DJ. And we had quite a lot of good bands up there. We had Steam Packet turned up with, you know, nights I was DJing with Rod Stewart and Julie Driscoll, right. Lock John Waldron, and Elton John on the piano. Really? It was because what? They were all subsidiaries of right. different bands. I mean, he played with Long John Baldry's blues organisation. I can't remember the exact name of their band at that time. So he was with him. And then you'd got Brian Allgott as well on the organ. So you got the organ and the piano, so who had originally been with the Julie Driscoll in the Brian Allgott Trinity. They all came together. That was a mishmash of future stars. And we had John Lee Hooker, Don Covey, that wrote a lot of Motown stuff, Clarence Frogman Henry. The Gas were a favourite band that used to come down, an Irish band. That didn't really sort of make it recording-wise, but they were really sought after, this band. So we used to have some good occasions, but they didn't used to come on till about 3 o'clock. And to be honest with you, I did actually play a part in introducing ska on the scene, because I had a lot of black friends. For instance, the Henry Brothers, who were good dancers and that. They were, this was pre-reggae days, you know, the ska beat and all that. And I knew a DJ myself that I brought in called Chop Chop. So we bring chops in at 2 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock, and then the band would come on at 3. So in fact, I would play a couple of hours, and then I would pick up the pieces again later and play till 6 o'clock.
Right.
And then I'd play out in the, you know, with slower stuff like Curtis Mayfield, the Impressions, that kind of thing. And then figure out where, you know, people would sort of like wander off to a party or something like that. Right. But a lot of the girls, they were very young, and their mothers, they didn't even know they were out clubbing. Yeah. You know, they'd go out with their friends of an evening, go back home about sort of 10 or 11 o'clock on the last bus home. And then they'd sneak out the window, you know, out the bedroom window or something, and then nip off down the Burlesque, you know, and then stay down there and then get back home again before their parents were coming. So not a lot of that going on, but I did that, and for a time, the very first night, Tony came down and he said, "Where were you?" I said, "Well, you know, they gave me an offer I couldn't refuse." Basically, and so we didn't really speak for about 6 months, and then when I left, Tony naturally took over, and then the more famous Night Out Club took over in Leicester. So that was that sort of later period, 1966. Thank you.
Well, we've done it all before.
I know we have. I want to hear it again. Come on.
The story can go on and on, but then you would have to trace everyone else that had a red suede jacket. There'd always be a bit of people that, like, remembered red suede jackets. There'd be the people that had red suede jackets. And there'll also be the people that have been intrigued by the way the red suede jackets actually played a part in the 60s. Especially if they had leather collars.
If they had what?
Leather collars.
Oh, leather collars.
Twin vents. And they were sewn up a little bit in between. I wouldn't have even thought about it if you hadn't suggested it.
Would you not?
Not really.
Would you never have remembered it again?
I would have remembered it, yes. But I wouldn't have expected anyone else to be intrigued with it.
Right.
You know, to that level.
Well, that's interesting.
Why?
That you would not have thought it significant after all this time. But has my reviving it, has that revived any interest with you in this subject? I mean, has that made you reconsider it in any way?
Over the years.
Or do you just still think, well, Will's interested in it, but that's because he's entrenched in the past, or
no,
he's...
No, I mean, if I was to able to feel that jacket now, to hold it in my arms, and to feel the lushness of the suede, the rawness of the leather on the collar, the feeling of maybe just hanging it over my shoulders, just one final moment, would have been worthwhile. That's it. I can't do it anymore. I would hold it like a baby, and I would caress it in my arms, and it would bring back so many memories that I'm sure they would have come flooding back. And it would have been nice to have felt the pockets lining to feel if there was anything left behind from years ago. It may have been sewn in to the lining. It would have been just such a pleasure to have held that for a moment, even though life has moved on. That red suede jacket still has a major part to play as a memory in my life.
It's Sunday, the 2nd of August,
yeah.
2015, in Jelly's, what do we call it? The Den, the recording studio?
The Jelly Suite.
The Jelly Suite. Okay. And on drums, we have Jell Nixon. On
keys.
Keys.
Yeah, keys. Yeah, Moog synthesizer.
Yeah.
And Korg SV-1.
Yeah.
We have myself, which is Lee Spregbury.
And do you have a working name? Do you have a kind of title?
Hopscotch Boulevard.
Hopscotch Boulevard. Okay. What's this one?
This is a track called Folk.
It's one of our own.
It's one of our own.
Yeah.
And we call it Folk.
Yeah.
One, two, three. Thank you.
You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and that was The Red Suede Jacket Part 2, a collage of audio sketches and memoirs about and by John Nixon, also known as Jelly, with observations by friends Steph Rayner and Bob Hughes. And the final track was by Hopscotch Boulevard, being Joel Nixon on percussion and Lee Spreadbury on keyboard. The programme was produced by William English and edited by Dan Wilson.